top of Daf Samaches Amud Aleph. If you remember, in the Mishnah, it would seem that Rabbi Akiva derived the law regarding a machshefa, gathering together cucumbers from Rabbi Yeshua. That's what it says in the Mishnah. So the Gemara asks, Vaha Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yeshua, Gomerle, is it really true, in fact, that Rabbi Akiva derived this from Yeshua Vasanya? Now the Gemara is going to quote a long brisa, which has many different parts to it. And this is the Agadita that will finish up the seventh parak. And in this Agadita, it becomes clear that Rabbi Akiva derived this teaching from Rabbi Eliezer. Vasanya kishachola Rabbi Eliezer. Now keep in mind that Rabbi Eliezer was put into Nidui, and that Nidui continued to accompany him until he died. But now he's on his deathbed. Nichnasu Rabbi Akiva v'chaver of Levakro. At this point, at the end of his life, Rabbi Akiva, together with other of Rabbi Akiva's colleagues, entered into Rabbi Eliezer's room. We'll see exactly where they sat in just a minute. And they came to learn Torah from him. Hu yoshev bekinov shelo, vehem yoshvim betraklin shelo. It seems that they distanced themselves from him in order to observe the nidui. So they didn't want to enter into Rabbi Eliezer's room immediately, but rather they sat in the parlor on the outside. That's called the traklin. He, on the other hand, was inside and he was in his bed. V'osa yomer of Shabbos hoya. It was right before Shabbos, and therefore they couldn't, you know, after he passed on, they couldn't bury him until Motzai Shabbos. V'nichnas hurkenes b'no lachlots tefillah. So Rabbi Eliezer was again the son of Hurkenes, and his son was Hurkenes. And his son Hurkenes came to remove his tefillah, his father's tefillin, because the law is that we don't wear tefillin on Shabbos. Now that's not a Doraisa halacha, that's a Drabbanan halacha. And the reason why the Rabbanan instituted this gzera not to wear tefillin on Shabbos is because they were afraid that a person might walk with these tefillin on his head from Rishus HaYoch to Rishus HaRabim, and since there's no kiyum of tefillin on Shabbos, Shabbos is an os, and tefillin is an os, so the os of Shabbos trumps the os of tefillin. Therefore, it's considered that he's carrying the tefillin. Now, it's not 100% clear that that's called carrying, but let's say at the very least, on a Rabbanan level, it's called carrying, and the Rabbanan, therefore, made a takona gzera that they shouldn't wear tefillin on Shabbos because he might go out into Rishus HaRabim wearing the tefillin. So that the law was that if Shabbos was approaching, you had to remove your tefillin, and that's what Hurkenes, the son of Rabbi Eliezer, was doing. He was coming into the room to remove the tefillin from his father. Now, it would seem at this point that Rabbi Eliezer did not remove his tefillin on his own. I mean, one could say that he wasn't capable of doing so if he was near death, or possibly it might mean that his mind was not thinking clearly at that point, and that's why he failed to take off his tefillin. And then, Garbo v'yotze ben Ezifa, Rabbi Eliezer rebuked his son, Garbo, and Hurkenes left the room binazifa, as if he was rejected, in a state of despondency, of shame. Omer lahem lechaverov. And at this point, the son, Hurkenes, turns to the entire entourage here, Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues, and he says, Kimiduma anisha daito shal abba nitrifa. it would seem that my father is no longer thinking lucidly, because why would he throw me out when all I wanted to do was take off his tefillin? And somehow, as he said this, his father, Rabbi Eliezer, overheard it. Omar Lehem, so he sort of like he exclaimed, Daito Vidas Imo Nitrifa. It's not my mind that's befuddled, it's the mind of Hyrcanus and his mother. Hech menichim isa skila vioskim bi isa shvus. Why are you getting involved? It's Omer Shabbos with an Isur Shvus, meaning the prohibition against wearing tefillin on Shabbos is in the worst case scenario only a Shvus derabanan. And there are more serious issues here that might come to Skila that are pressing now, right before Shabbos. For example, if, let's say, they weren't careful about hadlokas near Shabbos, or to make sure that all the food was prepared and heated up before Shabbos, they might possibly come to a situation where they could light the candles after it's too late, or they might cook something on Shabbos, and that would be a violation of an Isur Skila. Tefillin, in the worst case scenario, is only a Derabanan. Because, according to Doraisa law, even if he would go out into Arusha Saram wearing tefillin, that would not be an Isur Hotzah Doraisa. Because tefillin, insofar as they are a Takshit or a Beged, and you wear it during the week, even on Shabbos, that would not be an Isur Hotzah. So what's going on here is that tefillin should be removed before they light the Shabbos candles, and that's why Hyrcanus, according to the normative halacha, wanted to remove the tefillin before they would light Shabbos. However, since things were delayed until the very last minute, all the preparations for Shabbos were delayed because of Rabbi Eliezer's sickness, therefore Rabbi Eliezer thought that he should reproach his family and rebuke them because they were busy removing tefillin when they should be more dedicated to something more essential, much more halachically pressing, and that is to take care of the preparations for Shabbos. And in the case, why did he come down hard on his own wife, the mother of Hyrcanus? Because you're talking about a chiyuv on the woman to light Shabbos candles. That's where we should be taking care of all this. And you see what a lamdin Rabbi Eliezer was. You know, he was the halachist par excellence. You know, he couldn't tolerate this kind of amaratzis where people were so preoccupied with the Isur Shvus of wearing tefillin on Shabbos, which is a very weak kind of Isur, and they should be dedicated to much more important things in terms of preparing for Shabbos. Kaman Sharo Chachom Shedaitim Yushevas Alav. At that point, of course, the Chachomim realized that Eliezer was working with a full deck. He was very sharp. Is Nichnesu V'yoshvu Lefon of Mirochok Arba Amos. They came from the Traklin into his room, again, keeping at a distance of Dalet Amos in order to comply with the laws of Nidui. And at this point, they would like to learn Torah from Rabbi Eliezer. Now, keep in mind that Rabbi Eliezer was put into Nidui in Bab Metzia Daf Nun Tes because of the famous Sugya of Tanur Shalach Noi, where he refused to accept the opinion of Chazal as far as whether that Tanur is Mekabel Tumah or not. And because he refused to kowtow to the Chachamim, because he knew the Halach was not like the Chachamim, he was put into Nidui. Now, of course, here they kept at a distance from him because of the Nidui. They didn't want to point that out to him. Amar lehem lama basem. And at this point, he, Rabbi Eliezer, turns to them and he wants to know, why did you come to me? Meaning, where were you until now? Amru lo lilmo Torah banu, we came to learn Torah from you. Amalem v'yadachshav lama lo basim, why did you come until now? Amru lo lo hayolanu pnai. They didn't want to tell him that the reason they didn't come is because of the nidui, and that would insult him, that they really deliberately avoided visiting him this whole time. They gave a lame excuse as if they were too preoccupied. They didn't have the opportune moment to come and visit Omer Lehem. Bamea ani if your musu misas atzmon, I would really be surprised if the Chachomim would die a natural death, meaning they're going to be put to death. Now, he's coming down very hard on them. Imagine they came to hear Torah from him. But basically, at least according to the Ben Ish Chai, what he was saying was that, you know what, they didn't achieve their potential in Torah because they should have studied underneath, and as a result, because they didn't reach their potential in Torah, in the knowledge of Torah, they will suffer violent deaths. And he was already predicting the situation of Haruge Malchus. So obviously Rabbi Eliezer didn't buy into this whole excuse that they didn't come to learn Torah with him because they were too busy. And even if Ilishitasam, if their argument was correct, then they're still guilty because they should have found the time. Omalo Rabbi Akiva Shali Mahu. In other words, if you're already prophesizing as to what's going to happen, tell me what's my situation. Shalcha kasha mishalahem. Your death will be more torturous than all the others. And the reason for that is, as Rashi indicates, and the Marsha expands upon this, is because your lave is as wide as the Mishkan, as the Beis HaMikdash. You certainly should have learned Torah by me. You should have certainly would have reached your greater potential had you come to study Torah from me. And therefore, in a sense, your punishment is that much even greater. And in fact, this is what's going to happen. Rashi says, "They shall live chapasua keulam v'ilu shimshani or shimashtani ha'isa." Lome Torah Harbe, therefore your punishment is going to be terrible. It's going to be torturous, and we know that what the Romans did, and they flayed his flesh with iron combs. This is the Gemara in Brachas Daf Samach Aleph. So that, you know, when you read the Piyutim, whether it's on Tisha B'Av or on, you know, the Elezker on Yom Kippur, you know, you get the impression that maybe Rabbi Akiva and his friends were put to death because of the sin of Mechiras Yosef as a substitute for them. But here you get the impression, no, that it was the absence of maximizing their potential through Shimush Talmid Chachom with Rabbi Eliezer. That's what caused their death. Now, whether this is true or not, you know, up in Shemayim, who knows? I mean, Rabbi Eliezer was obviously a very, very bitter man, knowing that he had a lot of Torah to teach, and they refused to learn Torah from him. And even in the episode for which they put him into Nidui, he thought that he was right, and he never regretted what he did. He always thought that the blame was with them. In any event, Rabbi Eliezer Notal Shtezer Osavi Nichon El Libo. He took his elbows and he placed them on his heart, or maybe the forearm. He took his forearm, sort of like crossing over his heart. Omar, and he declared, "Oy lachem shteizro osai, woe to my arms, shehen kishtei sifrei Torah sheniglolim. They are like sifrei Torah." In other words, the words of Torah are closed up when you roll up the Torah, and so too my chachma was concealed because the Talmidei Chachamim of the generation did not partake of my Torah. And here he refers to his arms, and the Marsha points out that the word for an arm is a zroa. Zroa means strength and power. Rabbi Eliezer's power was his potential for teaching, and it was left. It did not it did not reach its potential. It did not realize itself in the world. And therefore, my zros, which is my power and my strength, oy, woe to my power and my strength, that it's like a sefer Torah that was neglolim, that was rolled up and was never used. Harbi Torah lamadati, harbi Torah limadati. I learned a lot of Torah, and I taught a lot of Torah. Harbi Torah lamadati, even though, and here he gets very humble, Rabbi Elias, and he says, even though I learned a lot of Torah from my Rebbeim, but lo chisarti merabosai afilu kikelev hamalaket minayam, from all of their knowledge, which is like the sea, I didn't take from their knowledge even as much as a dog that laps up the water from the sea, which obviously doesn't make any impact. In other words, the degree, the ratio of my knowledge doesn't decrease their knowledge, even but as far as the ratio of a dog lapping water from the sea is to the sea itself. But here's the main point that he says. Harbe Torah limadati, I taught much Torah in my lifetime, v'lo chisruni talmidai ela kimchol b'shfoferes. But my students did not diminish from my Torah knowledge. In other words, they didn't take advantage of what I had to teach. And if you want to take all the Torah that they learned from me and put that as a ratio, a number on top of what I had to teach them, the knowledge I had to teach them, then that ratio could be compared to kimchol b'shfofaris. You know, like the Rashi translates it as the eye power powder, excuse me, the eye powder in a tube is reduced by one dip of the applicator, and that's very little. And basically we're saying that the students, in terms of their acquisition of his knowledge, he used a more complementary analogy. Because in the first case, you know, a dog doesn't lap up anything from the sea. But here, okay, it's a small amount, but there is some amount. And he, in a sense, confessed that the students did take out a certain significant ratio of knowledge, some degree of knowledge. And when he refers to himself in terms of what he took from his Rebbeim, he's a shafel, he's an unav, and he says he didn't really make a dent, he didn't diminish the ratio of his Torah's of his teacher's knowledge to his by even a minute degree. In any event, it seems that Rabbi Eliezer was saying that his students didn't really diminish his knowledge, they didn't take much from his knowledge, and probably he's saying that he continued to learn Torah from his teachers, but the Chachamim, because of the Nidui, they excommunicated him, they ceased to learn Torah knowledge from him. This is all, like, in a sense, the bitter kind of chastisement of Rabbi Eliezer in his last moments on this earth. V'lo od, elo shani shone shlosh me'os halochas b'baheres aza, in the laws of Tzaras, baheres, which is a skin of affliction, it's white in color, a type, a category of Tzaras, and there are different shades of baheres. He says that there are 300 different dinim that define the various shades of baharis in order whether considered tzaras or no. V'loya adam sheshalani b'hem dover mi'olam. And yet no one asked me about this. Nobody tried to learn from me all that I had. Nobody questioned me about them. And he's saying, he's basically bemoaning the fact that not only didn't the Chachamim exhaust his knowledge, there were areas where it didn't even occur to them to raise the question. They didn't realize how much knowledge I had. V'yamri le shloshes alofim alochas, others say it was 3,000 laws. And then b'netias kishuim, in the laws of kishuf, they could have learned from me all the details about literally planting cucumbers or kishuim. I don't know if they're cucumbers or maybe they're squash. V'loya adam shalani by him, Dover Miolam, nobody even questioned me, nobody asked me about it. Chutz mi Akiva ben Yosef, except for Rabbi Akiva. And here's where we learn that Rabbi Akiva asked Rabbi Eliezer questions about Netiyas Kishuyim. Now again, I don't know why the Braisa here uses the word Netiyas Kishuyim, which means planting. I think the sorcery here was to gather the cucumbers. And no one asked them questions about this area of knowledge to know the laws of Mechashev. You know, it's when you put a sorcerer to death. And now the Braisa tells us the circumstances in which Rabbi Akiva asked the question about Netiyas Kishuyim Pamachas. Ani vehu mahalchim hayinu baderech. We were walking together. Omar li, Rabbi Lamdeni benetiyas kishuim. So Rabbi Akiva turns to Rabbi Elias and he says, teach me about the planting of squash. Amarti dovar echad. Nismala kol asada kishuim. I enunciated one single word and the entire field filled with cucumbers. Now again, this is an act of sorcery, and the question is, what's the hetafim to do it? Omar li, Rebbe limaditani nitiyosam. You taught me about planting them, limaditani akirosam. Tell me how the sorcerers are able to gather together and uproot these squash. So it seems again that in the sorcery there are two stages here, or two actions. There's one action of planting, and there's another action of gathering. And in both cases, Rabbi Elezer actually demonstrated his to Rabbi Akiva these two forms or categories of sorcery. Now, at this particular point, it would seem that Rabbi Eliezer finished his rebuke against them, his diatribe, whatever the word is, and at this point, Chazal began to ask him questions about the laws of Tumah V'Tahara, of which he was an absolute scholar, an absolute baki. He was the expert. Omulo, and they gave him a whole list of various kinds of kelim, right? To learn the laws of Tumah, you have to learn Masechta Kelim, which is a very difficult and complicated area. Now, these items which they list here, Hakadur, Vaimus, Vakamea, Utsara Margolius, and Mishkolas Ketana, literally translated, we're talking about a ball, a shoe form, an amulet, a peer pouch, a small weight. And in each of these cases, they sealed the object with a leather casing. So in other words, give the example from Mishkolas Ketana, small weight, that was made of lead. It was wrapped around in leather, and that would protect it. Larger weights were usually left uncovered. They weren't necessarily protected by leather. And the question becomes now, Mahu, what's the status? Are they Mekabel Tumah, or are they not Mekabel Tumah? In other words, leather, if you have an article, a kli that's made of leather, is Mekabel Tumah, but only if it has what's called a kli kibul. It has to have a receptacle to it. And this is derived from a pasuk in Vayikra, Perek Yud Aleph, that deals with Tumah. Now, if you have a sack, then a sack is considered a clay kibul. It's a receptacle. And in an article of leather is susceptible only if it can function, if it could serve as a receptacle, as a clay kibul, and that's codified in the Mishnah in the second parak of Kalim. Now there was a machlokas between the Chachomim and Rabbi Eliezer about all these Kalim that are mentioned here, the Kadur, Va'imus, and so forth. According to Chazal, since they were they were sewn up after they were filled up, then it's now closed up and it's not a receptacle, and therefore it's not mekabel tumah. Rav Lazar, on the other hand, was of the opinion that even though the receptacle part was filled in, nevertheless, since originally there was a hollow, therefore it still remains roy lekabel tumah. And now at this point, the Chazal are asking Rabbi Lezer, in the moments before his death, did he change his mind? Did he accept the opinion of the Chachamim? And another question that they were asking him was that, let's say they tear open this leather, and now can they put the entire kli into a mikveh? Or do they have to take out what's inside of the leather pouch? And we're going to see that Rabbi Lezer's answer, Omer lehen hein tmeim v'tarasim v'mashahein, that they are mekabel tumah, and not only that, you can be mitayer them as they are. You don't have to empty them out in order to put them into the mikveh. It becomes clear that he, Rabbi Lezer, continued to hold fast to his original opinion. And this was against Chazal. They asked him another question. Minal shal gabia imus mahu. There's something called a shoe form. What is a shoe form? This was an oblong leather skin shaped like a foot, and it was filled with hair, sewn shut. Shoemakers would use that to craft shoes upon this form. And mahu, is it mekabel tumah, is it not? Omer lehem, hu tahor. It's not mekabel tumah. And once again, he maintained against the Chachamim, this submission at the end of Kalim, that if you have an unfinished kli, it's not mekabel tumah, but Rabbi Lezer was of the opinion that this shoe is unfinished because it was placed into the shoe form. So while it's on the shoe form, it's not susceptible to kabel tumah, even though the rest of the process, everything is set. The Chachamim maintain that since removing from the shoe from the form doesn't require skilled labor, it doesn't require umnus, it's a maisa hejot, therefore it's considered finished, it's complete, and therefore it's mekabel tumah. And once again, the Chazal wanted to know, did Rabbi Eliezer still maintain his original position? And the answer is yes. And then v'yotza nishmaso b'tahara. His last word on this earth was Tahar, and Yotza Nishmaso Bitaro. Omad Rabbi Yeshua Raglovi Omar Hutar Neder Hutar Neder. In other words, the initial excommunication, the Nidui, was only during his lifetime. Now he's dead, and we can do whatever we have to do to prepare his body for a funeral and the whole funeral procession, because he is the Hutar Neder, is no longer a Nidui. And L'motzoi Shabbos, after Shabbos ended, there wasn't enough time to bury him before Shabbos, because this whole event took place right before Shabbos. Pogba Rabbi Akiva Min Kisri Lelud. Literally, what this means is that Rabbi Akiva actually walked from Caesarea to Lud to accompany the coffin of Rabbi Eliezer. In other words, coffin is maybe not a good word, but to be malava the mess for Kvura. But this is very strange, because the Gemara back on Daf Lamed Beis tells us that Rabbi Eliezer was in Lud. So how could it be that they're going from Caesarea to Lud unless he was, you know, he was resting up in Caesarea? That's not clear to me. In any event, this whole Agadah is full of so many what would seem to be aberrations of halacha, violations of halacha. For example, there's a lavda oraisa of viseret lenefesh lositein lositnu bibsarchem in Parshas Kedoshim. We're not allowed to dig into the flesh. And here the Gemara testifies that Rabbi Akiva digged into his flesh until his blood was flowing onto the ground. What's the heter for that? I don't know. So if you take a look at Tosus, he seems to say that this wasn't an act of mourning for the loss of Rabbi Eliezer, but for the loss of his Torah. I don't know, that's a little bit difficult. In any event, Pasach Olav Bishura V'Omar. In other words, there's a whole line of people that were around, you know, around the coffin, and it was time for the eulogy. So Rabbi Akiva goes up and he says the following. This is a pasuk from Malachim, which Elisha eulogizes his Rebbe Elio Navi, who's going up to heaven, and he says, "Avi Avi Rechev Yisrael Uparashav." So Rabbi Akiva took this pasuk and he applied it to Rabbi Eliezer, and perhaps Rechav Yisrael Parashav is a kind of intimating a battle, so to speak, you know, chariots and horsemen. And he was one who battled in matters of Torah, and he didn't, his prowess in Torah, to debate Torah, was unequaled. Harbe mos, yeshli ve'enli shulchan el artzosom. I have a lot of questions to ask in Torah, but I have no one to ask them to. And the mashal here of the money changer, because in the old days they used to hire a money changer to take a look at coins and evaluate them, because coins would lose their value over the course of time. Rabbi Akiva was like a layman who didn't have any expertise. He didn't know the value of something. He didn't know the value of halacha or the Torah knowledge, and therefore he had doubts in so many areas. He wanted to ask his questions to Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer is gone. Ein li shulchani lahartzosom. In any event, getting back to our Mishnah, Alma mi Rabbi Eliezer Gemara, why does that Mishnah testify that the one who taught Rabbi Akiva about the gathering together the Kishuim was Rabbi Yeshua, when in fact it was Rabbi Eliezer? The answer is Velo Svara. Even though Rabbi Eliezer demonstrated this to him, Rabbi Akiva still didn't understand it. Hadar Gemara, who finished it up and embellished it, may Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua was the one, V'Azbra Nila, who explained it to him fully. Now the Gemara asks the question that we raised before, Hechi Ovid Ha'achi, how could Rabbi Eliezer do the sorcery with the Kishuim, Anan Tanan, Ha'osa Maisa Chayev? This is sorcery is a capital crime. L'slamed Shaini. If it was done for the purpose of teaching, but not for the purpose of sorcery, then it's okay, then it's mutter. The Omar Mar, Lo Silmad Lasos. The Pasuk here says in Vayikra that Lo Silmad Lasos, meaning you're not allowed to learn or imitate the nations of the world in their forms of sorcery, and that's lasos. But lasos iatolomed, avolatolomed lahavin ulahoros. So you're not allowed to study what the various forms of sorcery of the goyim in order to imitate them and to act accordingly, but rather you can study them in order to understand them and teach their dinim. And as a matter of fact, the Gemara back on Daf Yud Zayin pointed out that the members of Sanhedrin had to be experts in sorcery in order to prosecute sorcerers. Hadron Alecha Arba Misos Bezd. Now we have Perek Ches. And since the Mishnah earlier had listed all the cases which are punishable by Skila, and we've already studied almost all of them, but the one case we didn't study, which is listed there as Achiv Skila, is Ben Sorer Umore. Now, the Mishnah here at the beginning of the 8th Perek and throughout this Perek is going to study and elaborate the laws of a Ben Sorer Umore. Who is a Ben Sorer Umore? Who is a rebellious son? What did he do? And now we're talking about a boy who has committed certain sins. Basically, he's a zolel v'sove. He's guilty of gluttony. He's guilty also of stealing from his father in order to enjoy life, to take that money and enjoy life. He was warned by his parents. He continuously ignored the warnings of his parents. He was brought into Bezdin and he got Malkus. That we're going to have later on in Daf Ayin Aleph. And he continues even after the Malkus and after all these warnings and admonishments to again this behavior pattern of stealing and of gluttony, and he's going to be put to death through skila. And this is what the parak is dedicated to try to understand the various dinim. We're going to soon see that the criterion and the requirements, the conditions have to be met for him to be chayav misa, so strict and so severe that there's not even a chance that it would ever happen. And therefore, the punishment of stoning was never actually meted out to a ben sor mar drosh v'kabel schar. In any event, if you take a look in the Meiri, he points out that the reason why the Masechta dedicates an entire chapter to Ben Sora Morer is because the laws of Ben Sora Morer are so complex and there are so many conditions that we need a separate chapter that's dedicated to the laws of Ben Sora Morer to understand what it's all about. The Mishnah says, Ben Sora Morer me'emosai nasa Ben Sora u'morer. In other words, we're talking about a young boy. We'll soon see that this is the exclusion of a girl. She can never become a bas soru morer, only a ben. Torah says ben. And ben indicates that he's a boy. But he's not punishable for skila unless he's already a bar mitzvah. So why do you call him a boy? Apparently, on the one hand, he has matured and he became a gadol. But on the other hand, he's still a boy. So what is that period of time? So Misha Yavish Shtei Saras, number one, the first condition is that he became a gadol, he's no longer cotton because he has Shtei Saros. Now again, Shtei Saros means two saros that were grown after he reached the age of 13. That's called Shanim, because if he hasn't reached Shanim, he doesn't have the maturity of a 13, he doesn't have the age of a 13-year-old, then his simonim, meaning his shtei saros, are called shuma. That's not called halachically simonim. So, number one, we're talking about a Jewish boy becomes an adult, number one, when he's 13, and number two, he grows two pubic hairs. And the Gemara mentions that this boy has to be shloshes revi yom echad. However, the yom echad doesn't mean literally one day. It means into the 14th year, which means after he hits his 13th birthday plus even a moment. And he grows two pubic hairs after his birthday. Even on his birthday, he becomes an adult. He becomes a gadol. And therefore, he could be punished in a bez. And he could be tried, convicted, and put to death in this case of a ben soru morer. But now, since the Torah calls him a ben, which obviously means that he's young, up until what age is he still considered a ben? At what point is he considered, so to speak, a man who has reached full adulthood? And the Mishnah says, ad, until the point of sheyakif zokon. Now the word zokon here is a euphemism for the pubic hairs, and zokon means a beard. When is he considered a full-grown man? That's when he has a full beard, so to speak, in that area of his body. But until that time, he has produced two saros, and he's still considered a ben. He's still young. He hasn't yet got to the point of yakif zakan. And during that time period, we'll see exactly how long that is, he is subject to the law and can be convicted as a ben soru morer. The Mishnah explains what the word zakon means over here. What does it mean? Not yakiv zakon, atachton. It's referring to the pubic areas, the lower areas below elyon, but not the facial beard. This was the euphemism that Chazal used in the Mishnah, Rebbe in the Mishnah, in order to refer to pubic hair. Chazal didn't want to be very explicit about that area of the body. Shenemar. Now, how do we know that there is this upper age limit, the ceiling? Ki yel ish ben. Now, first, the Mishnah goes on a little bit of a tangent here. Ben velo bas. The first thing we derive from the word ben is that the exclusion of a bas, a daughter cannot become a bas soru morer. The Rambam says because the chash of a ben soru morer is that he's so dedicated to his pleasures that who knows what he's going to do in order to support those pleasures. And in the case of a woman, that's not so shayach. But not only that, ben velo ish. He's not yet a fully grown man. Let's call him a youth. He's still a youth. He's young. And that's what the word ben is trying to teach us. And therefore, once he gets to the point of Yaakov Zakon Hatachton, then he's considered already an Ish, and he's out of the parasha of Ben Sorer Umorer. So basically, the derivation here from the word ben is to exempt a man, an Ish, from Ben Sorer Umorer. And we have to figure out exactly what that time period is between a youth and a man. When do we assume, after his 13th birthday, that he becomes a full, matured man, and he's no longer a ben, he's called an ish. Katan patur shelo ba lechlal mitzvos. The Mishnah says that we don't put a katan to death, even if he's in violation of all these laws of a ben sor morer. And for some reason, the Mishnah feels compelled to justify that. You and I would have said that you don't punish a katan. He's exempt, he's exonerated from all punishment. The Mishnah gives a more lumdisha answer, we don't know why it needs this, that he's a katan. But katan means he's not a bar avera. And it would seem, shelo ba lechlal mitzvos, that the Mishnah is trying to explain that he cannot be a ben sor morer because he's part of a mitzvah. And if he doesn't have any obligation to perform mitzvahs, he's not shayach to averos. And then add to boot the fact that even if he was shayach to averos, and even if a maisa katan would be a maisa avera, we'll have to discuss that at great length, nevertheless, he's not punishable. And the Gemara is now going to elaborate what does this mean when it says, shalo, why does the Mishnah need shalo ba lechlal mitzvahs? Katan minol de potor. And now the Gemara says, what do you mean katan minol de potor? The whole question here has to be justified. Minolon, kiriktoni taima, the Mishnah gave us a reason, shlo balichlal mitzvos, visu hecha ashkan to onish hakosu. So on two counts, he is excluded from being a ben soramar. Number one, he's a katan who's potami mitzvos, so he doesn't have a veris. Number two, you cannot punish a katan. You know, you can only punish a gadol. And that's the din. So, what is this whole discussion here about Minolon? What is your question? The Mishnah itself answers that question. Are you saying Minolon, you know, where do we find a pasuk to patter up a katan from the law of Ben Sora Morer? You need a pasuk for that? He's not punishable. If he's not punishable... So again, the Gemara is asking basically two questions. Number one, the Mishnah provides an answer to the question of why a katan is excluded from ben sorer morer. He doesn't have averus, and he can't be held liable for averus. He's a katan. He's not chayav in mitzvahs. And number two, even if the Mishnah had not given that explanation, we know that a katan is exempt from punishment. So why do you need a pasuk for this? And the Gemara answers, let me clarify what I meant when I asked the question. We know in Anan, Hachi Kamrin, this is what I wanted to ask. Atu ben soru mor al cheto nerag? You know, when you're talking about punishments for a crime, you're right, he's not liable and he's not punishable. Those two points are well taken. But the parasha ben soru mor has nothing to do with punishment. Ela what? He is al shem sofo nerag. Look at the averis that he committed. Did he commit any capital crime? He hasn't committed any capital crime. Or he steals. That's a very severe avera. He's gluttonous. Okay, that's a problem of deos and midos. But you can't say he's chayav misa. Hello, what al shem sofo nerag? We're afraid that ultimately he will become a murderer. He'll degenerate. In other words, he began his adult life stealing and gorging himself. Look what's going to happen down the line. So, Tori Yardel is so daito shall have been so remorrow. What's his destiny? If that be the case, then maybe even if he's a katan, a few katan nami, we should put him to death. The ode, and furthermore, ben velo ish katan mashma. When the pasuk says ben, right, it seems to imply that a ben is a katan. Right, we have two words in the Torah. We have Ish and we have a Ben. Ish is a gadol and Ben is a katan. So why not interpret the word Ben in the pasuk kipshuto, a straightforward way, the way it's always interpreted, and therefore even if he's a katan, he should be put to death. I'm Rabbi Yehuda Marav, the Omar Kra, Kiele Ish Ben. When a person has a son who is a Ben, Ben hasamach l'gvurasso shel ish. The you Rav says that you take these two words, Ish and Ben, that are written contiguous one to the other, and this is meant to teach us that we're talking about a son who is Samuch Leos Ish. Because he doesn't have the strength and the maturity of a full-fledged adult, but on the other hand, he is Samuch, he's close, meaning he's past the age of Godless, so he's technically no longer cutting and he's a guttle, but yet he's only Samuch L'Gvurasa Shel Ish, but he hasn't reached the Gvurasa Shel Ish. It says in the Mishnah, Ve'ad sheyakif zokon atachton, up until what age is he susceptible to be a Ben Sormorer? Tani Rabbi Chia, we learned in a Brisa, the name Rabbi Chia, ad sheyakif atara, in other words, until the pubic areas around the male organ are surrounded, and once he has that, then he's already a mature person, and he's no longer subject to ben soru morer. Ki osur of dimi omar hakofas gid v'lo hakofas beitzin. So Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, and he said that we're talking about the hair, the pubic hair that grows around the base of the male organ, but not the base and not the testicles itself. In other words, the testicles itself, that's already an older stage. That's really way beyond maturity. So we're limiting the area, we're limiting the age bracket of a Ben Sorer Morer from the time that he became Bar Mitzvah up until the time that his male organ is surrounded with a ring of pubic hairs. And according to Rav Dimi, a boy can only be a Ben Sormorer until that, or within that early stage, up until the point where the male member is ringed with hair. Now, earlier we had a drasha of Rav to derive the conclusion that a katan could not become a Ben Sormorer, even though Al-Shem Sofo Nerag. And now the Gemara says that drasha, which is based on the pasuk ben, is not acceptable according to Rav Chisda, because Rav Chisda uses that pasuk for something else. Katan shaholid ein bino nase ben sorer umorer. If a katan before the age of bar mitzvah, assuming he's physically capable of becoming a father of a child, knows if he has a relationship with a woman and she gets impregnated, that child that's born cannot become a ben sorer umorer. Why? Shenema ki yeh le'ish ben. And what that means is that an ish has a ben, and that ben is the ben of an ish, and therefore he could become a ben sorer umorer. But le'ish ben v'lo le'ben ben. But it means that if the ben is a ben to a ben, it means he's born from a katan, then he's not subject to the law of ben sorer umor. So we see that leish ben is derived, according to Rav Chisda, is the derivation for something else. It has nothing to do with the fact that a katan is excluded from ben sorer umor. Later on, the Gemara is going to question this very physiological premise of Rav Chisda, that a child can father a child. So the Gemara is asking, how could Rav Chisda use the pasuk this way when Rav derived a different halacha from the same pasuk? And the Gemara answers that perhaps we could derive two things from the same pasuk. Why? In Cain, because if we want to derive only Rav's din that a katan is excluded from being a ben sorer morer, and that means that the word ben here is attached to the word ish to tell me that it's a ben who is samuch, as we said, l'gvuras ish, is lema krakiya ben le'ish. If it would have said in the pasuk ben le'ish instead of le'ish ben, then we would have very satisfactorily have derived the conclusion of Rav that a katan is excluded. But why does it say kiya le'ish ben? That this ben has to be a ben of an ish, shmamina lichid Rav Chisda. It's also teaching the law of Rav Chisda. So where it says, v'yema kula l'hachi u'diyasi, maybe the pasuk is coming just simply to teach me the law of Rav Chisda. How do you know that we could also at the same time derive the derivation of Rav to exclude a katan? And the Gemara answers him, Cain, if the Pasuk was only coming to teach Rav Chisda's din, Neimakra ben ish, my li'ish ben. If it would have said ben ish, it would have meant the child of an ish, of a gadol, but not the child of a katan. My, why does it say li'ish ben? Shmami notarti that li'ish ben, the sequence here is telling us that it's got to be a ben who's samach li'ish. And again, on the other hand, you know, that itself is not the only derivation, because as we said earlier, it says le'ish ben. It should have said ben le'ish. So from these two diyukim, we derive these two halach. So pliga de Rabbah, and Rabbah could not accept the very premise underlying Rav Chisda, because Rabbah holds katan eino molid. A katan is not capable of fathering a child. And Rabbah quotes a pasuk in Bamidbar, at the very beginning of Bamidbar, to prove this point. Shenemar, it says, V'im ein le'ish goel. So this is a parsha of Keren V'chomesh, and we're talking about someone who steals money and denies that he stole the money, and he takes an oath, he takes a shvuah. Later on he does tshuva and he wants to admit the truth. He has to pay not only the Keren, but also the Chomesh. And supposing the person from whom he stole is dead, then he has to pay the Yarshim. And we're going to discuss the case of Gezel Ager. If, let's say, the person who died is a Ger and he has no Yarshim. So it says, V'im ein lo ish goel, v'chiyesh adam b'Yisrael she'ein lo goel. How could he have, there's no possibility of a Jewish person not having any relatives. Ella beger, begezel ager akosu b'dabra. Only in the case of a ger, it's possible, since ger kikot and shenoladom, he's not related to any of his biological relatives. Therefore, he leaves no yarshin. And in this case, the Torah says, V'im ein lo ish goel, then the money has to be paid to the Kohen, because there's no one else to whom to pay this penalty for the shvuas shekel. And now we turn to Daf Samach Tesam and Aleph, V'yom Rachmona Ish, and the Torah says that Ish, it could have said in the Pasuk, V'yim Ein Lo Goel, what's Ein Le Ish Goel, Ish Atatzorach Lachzer Olav, Im Yesh Lo Goel Im Lav. The Gazan has a responsibility to find the Nigzal's Yarshim, to see who is alive to inherit him, but that's only if he's an Ish. But Katan, if he was a Katan, this Nigzal, if the victim of the Gzeila, Atatzorach, you don't have to look and see if he has any relatives. Again, in the case of a convert, of a ger, he couldn't have any children because a katan cannot father a child. There's a long tosis here on Daf Samach Esam, very famous tosis. Tosis says, how can we have a doraisa about a katan in terms of ownership, that the victim of this gzeilu is a katan? Is there bailus to a katan doraisa? A katan doesn't have aviyad for zchiyah. Tosus offers possibilities of dasacheres machne, or maybe mufla samach liish has a separate category. But then the more fundamental question is, can a katan be a ger? And the answer is that there is such a thing as gerus for a katan. The question whether that's doraisa or not. And Tosus has a very unique derivation. He wants to say towards the end of this very long Tosus that at the time of Matan Torah, There was a gerus for all of Klal Yisrael, and that's the source for ger katan matbilin also al das bezdin. Now the gerus at the time of Matan Torah was a full fledged gerus d'oraisa, right? Matzinu she avosenu nichnasu lebris b'milo tefil v'artzos damim v'kama ktanim oyu b'shas Matan Torah, and yet all of these were gerim gemurim d'oraisa. And from Matan Torah, we derive the conclusion that there's such a thing as Gerus Doraisa. Tosfos then asks the question, so why is it Igdiu Yicholim Limchos? If it's a Gerus Gemura, how could it be Mecha? That's the subject of this Tosfos. Now, Abai is going to challenge Rabbah's view and see if maybe in truth we can prove from other sources that a child could possibly father a child. And that will pick up in Mirtz Hashem in the next shiur.